Okay, I'd like to call today's meeting of the House Resources Committee to order. Today is February 12th, 2024. We are in Capitol Room 124. We have Representative Mears, Representative Armstrong, Representative Dibert, Representative McCabe, Representative Baker, Representative Sadler, and myself, Chairman Tom McKay. We have a quorum to do business. Let's see. I would like to thank the staff, our regular crew, Zach, Justin, and Ed, for helping us run the meeting. Please put your cell phones on silent. We have three bills on the roster today. I'm going to change the order. We were going to consider HB 257 first, but I'm going to move HB 296 up into the first position. So I'll now bring House Bill 296, which is called the Crop Act, before the committee. Today we have Rena Miller, Brent Goodrum, and Brian Scoresby, all with the DNR, Department of Natural Resources, to present the bill. So if you would come forward and please state your name and your affiliation and begin your presentation on HB 296.
Good afternoon, Chair McKay, and members of the House Committee, House Resources Committee. For the record, my name is Brent Goodrum. I'm the Deputy Commissioner of the Alaska Department of Natural Resources, here to present on House Bill 296, or the Crop Act. The legislation is intended to incentivize food production in Alaska, and it's particularly fitting to discuss it as this is Food Security Week. Governor Dunleavy introduced HB 296 as a series of immediate steps boosting the state policies already in statute, while we continue to work on short, medium, and long-term recommendations and actions. Governor Dunleavy's overarching goals with HB 296 are to increase food security and independence for Alaskans and to grow and expand Alaska's agriculture economic sector. Let's first take a quick look at agriculture in Alaska today. A robust agricultural sector has long been a vision of Alaska's leaders for years. Agriculture is even prominently displayed on the seal of the state of Alaska. According to the USDA's 2017 National Agricultural Statistics Service Census of Agriculture, there were nearly 1,000 Alaska farms and ranches that produced about $29.6 million in crop value and $40.8 million in animal production. But a state as big and diverse as Alaska surely has the potential to do so much more, given the proper support. Why grow the agricultural sector in Alaska? As Alaskans, we simply require greater food security and independence for all Alaskans. We need to continue to diversify our economy and further develop our emerging economic sectors. We also need to be upfront and honest about some key challenges to agriculture in Alaska. Farming and ranching are high-cost, high-risk businesses. New farmers in particular are often starting literally from scratch with a clearing of raw Alaska land. When it comes to market access, market needs aren't always able to be accommodated by a still young agricultural industry. The challenges of supply and demand sometimes prevent our growers from scaling up, given the uncertainty of markets. There's a lack of infrastructure on farms and in the state broadly, a lack of transportation to markets, a lack of access to more state land suitable for agriculture, a lack of access to cheap power, a lack of processing and production facilities. And lastly, a real demand for skilled agricultural workforce. Where will our next generation of farmers and laborers come from, as many of our current farmers are aging out? The key challenges for agriculture in Alaska seem like the proverbial chicken and egg dilemma. What can we as Alaskans do differently now? Where can the state best be a catalyst for dynamic, meaningful change in our agriculture sector?
So, Mr. Goodrum, I'd like to just announce that Representative Rauscher and Representative Wright have joined us. Thank you.
HB 296 considers structure already found in exacting or existing statutes and builds on three major components that have been championed and prioritized by stakeholders and task forces in more recent years. Those three major components form the acronym CROP. C stands for capital access. R stands for revenue protection. And OP is covered by open procurement. Again, based on recommendations by task forces, division experts, stakeholders, and policy priorities. These components were selected for their ability to get direct support to the industry quickly with minimal new staff or new programs to be developed. Capital access, the C in the CROP Act. The Board of Agriculture and Conservation is responsible for management of the Agricultural Revolving Loan Fund, or ARLF, which is a key source of capital for farmers and producers. HB 296 seeks to be responsive to the evolving agriculture industry needs. The board is comprised of a working citizen board. All seven seats are currently filled, but it's difficult at times to meet the five-person quorum statutory requirements. This can unnecessarily delay action on loan applications and approvals. Reducing the quorum from five to four members will help increase efficiency of the board. With respect to expanding activities eligible for ARLF loans, the bill will add shipping or transportation as an eligible activity to qualify for an ARLF loan as recommended by recent task forces. The intent is to pave the way for new agricultural-focused transportation cooperatives that will help reduce shipping costs into and around Alaska. The bill will also allow refinancing of ARLF and other loans, assuming applicants and activities are ARLF eligible. A $2 million capital infusion to ARLF will be the first capital injection to the fund since 1986 and will boost available capital to lend by almost 20%. The reason for the infusion is to ensure ARLF has resources to meet what we think will be additional demand due to the bill's attractive provisions. The bill also seeks to revise loan caps currently set in statute that are difficult to update over time to keep pace with inflation. I'd like to note that $100 nearly four decades ago is roughly the equivalent of $300 in today's economy. The current cap max is $1 million in total loans to any one borrower. The board will set new loan limits and ceilings in regulation, a process that will require a thorough public process, including notice and public input. The data points on the left of this slide are of interest. There are currently 52 active ARLF loans. The chart on the right gives insight into the types of activities ARLF is currently loaning for and the relative dollar amount of loans in each category. The takeaway is agriculture in Alaska is diverse, and ARLF's loan portfolio reflects that. I'd like to note that the total principal value is what you add there, the balance plus authorized, and so that's currently at $21.4 million. Revenue protection, the R in CROP. The concept of state funding the premiums for federal crop insurance is in statute already, although it was never funded. This bill revises the support formula. The fiscal note includes capital to pay for the state support. $2 million would support crop insurance premiums for current acres under production and allow for additional acres in the program. The intent of the state-financed revenue protection is to incentivize production, to boost feed supply, and support larger livestock herds on the Alaska landscape. This helps offset risk and enables, particularly new farmers, to invest in agricultural infrastructure and expansion of production. At current production and 2023 premium levels, the five-year cost of the program is approximately $900,000. Should participation in the program grow as desired, which would mean more acres under production, additional capital can be provided for premium support. The Alaska Farm Bureau and Task Force reports have indicated state support for insurance would help move the needle. Access to revenue protection policies will help increase access to capital and lower a farmer's risk while improving equipment like irrigation systems that boost production. The proposed legislation focuses on barley, wheat, and oats, because these are the foundational crops of the state's livestock food chain. More secure livestock feed should enable greater herd size, which in turn improves the throughput at slaughterhouses, improving the economics of those operations. The federal crop insurance revenue protection is important because it covers price and crop risks and could in the future be required for feed grain crops under the ARLF loan eligibility. As previously mentioned, eligible crops are those with revenue protection policies that are available. Essentially, those are barley, wheat, and oats. And essentially how the program would work is in years one and two, the state would pay 100% of the premium, and farmers would achieve a 85% revenue protection. In years three, four, and five, there are step downs. In both years three and four, the state would again pay 100% of the premium. In year three, the farmer would receive 80% revenue protection. In year four, that would step down to 75% revenue protection. In year five and beyond, the farmer would need to pay the premium to attain a 75% revenue protection. The state then would pay the additional 15% to reach 70% revenue protection. Any additional amount that the farmer wanted above that, they would pay themselves. So how this would work? The Resource Management Agency has approved insurance providers, about 14 of them nationwide. The approved insurance providers offer policies that on risk management agency set terms. The state is essentially acting as an enrollment function, verifying with state or with site visits that Farmer X is in fact growing Y acres of Z crop, and the state pays the bill as calculated by the risk management agency. The division is not getting into the insurance business. The role of the farmer would be to select the coverage at the desired level from an approved provider, report the acreage, and pay the premium not covered by the state. The state will not be adjudicating claims or covering losses.
So could I maybe ask you a question, Mr. Goodrum? Barley, wheat, and oats, and there must be, I guess, some yield track record in Alaska for how many bushels per acre, that, because it's probably different than Alberta or Kansas.
Right.
So there must be some established metrics on how many bushels per acre for those three, and that must be the basis for the insurance. Like if you're supposed to make 100 bushels an acre, and I don't know, there's a really bad season and you make 50 bushels an acre, then the revenue makeup would be for the 50 that you didn't make. Is that kind of saying it real simple?
Is it Chair McKay, yes. Close? The risk management agency has been tracking these numbers and productions in Alaska for a number of years.
Okay.
And so they have all of the stats on that. And so from an insurance perspective, they're quite comfortable in their understanding of production here in Alaska. And yes, from a layman's term, you described it very well.
Okay. Thank you.
We'll continue on slide 10. Open procurement, or the O&P of crop. Procurement preference already exist in statute. They apply to state agencies, school districts, and municipalities that receive state funds. What type of procurements would have preferences? Agricultural products grown in the state and fishery products harvested or processed in waters in which the state has jurisdiction. Some of the protections included within the legislation are: when responding to solicitation, sellers of eligible products must provide their current wholesale pricing lists. Debarment or civil penalties are possible for submitting inaccurate price information. Additionally, an annual report to the legislature with specific data requirements will be directed by this bill. Other than fishery products, currently the number of Alaska producers with the ability to provide the quantities these institutional buyers is very small. This is why increased spending isn't necessarily expected to be a significant issue. We know that there is more work to be done on potentially even more ways to connect growers and buyers, and the department will continue working on those. However, this is a step that we can take now. Task forces, the Farm Bureau, and others have all recommended more work on getting retailers to offer more Alaska-grown products. Greater access to more local markets creates more opportunity for producers to scale up and to increase our local food security and independence. At this time, I'm going to ask Special Assistant Rena Miller to join me here.
Okay, Rena Miller, please come forward to do the sectional overview. Please state your name and your affiliation, Rena, and do your presentation.
Thank you, Chair McKay and members of the committee. For the record, Rena Miller, Special Assistant to the Commissioner at DNR. Let's see here, just get myself sorted real briefly. So as we get into the sectional, it's just a very general overview. As Deputy Commissioner Goodrum explained, there's three main sections to the bill. Sections 1 through 6 deal with the capital access provisions. The revenue protection, federal crop insurance provisions are in sections 7 through 10 and 23. And then the open procurement sections are 11 to 22 and sections 24 to 25. There's four different effective dates in the bill. Each of these sort of categories of provisions takes effect at a different point in time. For the procurement provisions, where the bill expands the procurement preference for a period of 5 years, the bill also reverts with a delayed effective date in 2029 at the end of that 5-year period. So when you're going through the bills, you'll have a section where it sets the new procurement terms, and the next section looks real similar but undoes those effective in 2029. Next slide. So Section 1 reduces the 7-member Board of Ag quorum from 5 to 4. And again, I believe Deputy Commissioner Goodrum talked at length about this. Section 2 expands those activities that the Board of Agriculture and Conservation can loan from. Loans could be made to individual residents, partnerships, and corporations to cover shipping costs to and within Alaska, and to refinance debt either incurred, refinance debt issued already by the Board of Ag or issued by another lender, providing that the person with the loan meets the ARLF requirements. Section 3 removes the current statutory maximum of $1 million in outstanding loans to any one borrower. Instead, the Board of Ag would set that maximum by regulation. And of course, that would provide the board greater flexibility over time to keep pace with demand, inflation, and requirements, things like that. Section 3 will also revise loan security requirements so that farm development, chattel, and irrigation loans would have to be secured by a first priority real estate or chattel mortgage. Section 4, and these are still in the capital access kind of section of the bill, removes statutory caps that limit short-term emergency loans to $350,000 for borrowers that are in a farm disaster area, and $200,000 for borrowers that are not in a farm disaster area. The Board of Ag would be setting those maximums in regulation for borrowers that are in the farm disaster area. For those outside, the bill keeps the statutory cap but increases it to $500,000 for those short-term loans. And I do believe that the short-term loans are less than a year in duration. Section 5 would increase the maximum farm product processing loan from $250,000 to $500,000 and then make some corresponding adjustments to loan priority and securities. Section 6 removes a statutory cap of $250,000 for loans for clearing land. And again, this is one that the Board of Ag would be setting by regulation instead, the cap. Are there any questions before I move on to the next category, federal crop insurance?
Yeah, Representative Rauscher has a question.
Through the chair, thank you. You said you were going to remove, or this bill removes the $1 million ceiling for loans, and that it would be addressed through regulation. Is that what I heard correct?
Through the chair, yes, Representative Rauscher. The Board of Ag has authority to promulgate regulations and would do so to set that cap.
So, follow up?
Yeah, follow up, Representative Rauscher.
So is the idea of having it regulation to lower it or raise it?
Representative Rauscher, through the chair, I believe it's to allow flexibility and to raise that.
Follow up?
Yes, sir, Representative Rauscher.
So flexibility meaning it could be one for one person or one farm and not for another? I guess I'm trying to understand flexibility.
Representative Rauscher, through the chair, the flexibility is in updating that as conditions require year after year should they need to. Right now, with it set in statute, of course, that requires an act of the legislature to revise. This would provide the Board of Ag with that flexibility to do it by regulation.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Okay. Please continue, Ms. Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Section 7 starts into those sections relating to the revenue protection or the federal crop insurance premium support. Section 7 would increase the state's contribution towards the producer's federal crop insurance policy premiums for the revenue protection policies. It revises the state share from a maximum of 30% of a producer's premium on coverage. That was set, I believe, in 1980. And instead, it would be up to 65% of the recorded or appraised average yield to a, I'm sorry, that was part of the old one. We go to the tiered system that Deputy Commissioner Goodrum explained that would be on a percentage of revenue protection acquired. That's, again, going to be defined in Section 10. Section 7 ensures that the state's providing more state assistance, that 100% to equal 85% coverage over the first 2 years, decreasing over a couple of steps so that the level of revenue protection obtained by the state's full support decreases in years 3 and 4. And then in year 5, of course, the producer themselves will need to participate in that premium. Section 7 also replaces provisions that are repealed by Section 23 of the bill, and that relates to that old 1980s statutory language. Section 8 has conforming changes to align with Section 7. In Section 9, the Department of Natural Resources is allowed to adopt regulations for this program. In Section 10, the term revenue protection is defined in reference to the Code of Federal Regulations. And then in Section 11, we move on to the open procurement preferences. Are there any questions on the revenue protection sections before I move on?
Seeing none, please continue.
Section 11 is the procurement preference for municipalities that receive state money buying in-state agricultural products. And Section 7 then for this 5-year trial period, pilot period, removes the cost difference cap. So in effect, these municipalities will need to buy the in-state products no matter how much more they cost compared to outside products, providing that the product is available in similar quality. The current preference is that municipalities must buy it if it's no more than 7% more expensive than out-of-state products and may buy it if it's up to 15% more expensive. Section 12 returns in 5 years to current statute. That's 7% to 15%. Section 13 essentially does the same thing related to municipalities that are purchasing in-state fisheries products. And then Section 14, in the end of 5 years, reverts to the current preference for those fisheries products. Section 15 is where some of these protections that Deputy Commissioner Goodrum spoke about are, so that during this five-year period, when we're broadening that preference for Alaska products, people that are selling these agricultural or fisheries products need to submit their wholesale price lists when they're responding to a municipality's solicitation for purchase. And if they provide inaccurate pricing information, there are then penalties for doing so. In Section 16, we...
Can we go back one? I think I better ask a question that the public might be alarmed about. I believe it's Section 11 there when you said municipalities that receive state funds must buy in-state agricultural products no matter how much they cost. That sounded a little strange. And then when we define municipalities, you got to define municipalities, and then you're saying that if I grow carrots and my carrots are 10 bucks a piece, you got to buy them. I mean, you know, there's no ceiling there, or there's no, it seems like you could corner the market on carrots, or there could be some, you know, market manipulation. You see what I'm asking?
Sure, Chair McKay. So today in statute, there is a preference for in-state agricultural or fisheries products. And that preference applies to municipalities that receive state money that are also procuring these products, to local school districts, and to any agencies of the state. And that might be anything from Department of Health and Social Services, Department of Health related to maybe Pioneer Homes or the Alaska Railroad, catering lunches on train rides, to, you know, our correction systems. Right now, that preference says that if there is a similar product in-state to what you want to buy out-of-state, similar quality, then the in-state product gets a 7% preference, right? And so what the legislation would do is expand that to say that for a five-year trial period, we're not going to stop at 7%. If there's an in-state version of this product available, then you, with the state's institutional buying power, needs to purchase it. Again, I think, like Deputy Commissioner Goodrum pointed out, there are some protections to try and still be responsible with the fact that this is public money. And there are also, I think, a key aspect will be the reporting requirement that we get to a little later in the sectional. Ultimately, the five-year trial period combined with the reporting requirement should, you know, is intended to provide the legislature with data and information to determine how this procurement preference is working, and whether they would like to extend that or revert to the 7% or perhaps take another approach.
Okay, thank you for that explanation. It seems a little bit, I really like obviously the incentives to buy in state, of course, obviously, but seems a little bit non-free market, but I'll let Representative Sandler continue the question.
Mr. Chairman, I just have a question. We are on, I think, Section 20. This is a 30-section bill. Did you want to wait until all 30 sections have been laid out to allow questions for it? Or should we do questions on the sections as they come before us?
Well, why don't we do this page, and then we'll try to move on through the rest. So did you have a question on this page?
Yeah, before I move it down. Yeah.
Okay.
I guess I'd ask through the chair, Ms. Marina. What evidence do we have that the 7% preference is not effective, and what information would you say to the chairman's question, the unlimited cap on the obligation to buy in Alaska, would we capture most of that Alaska-grown product if we just raised it to 10% preference or 20 or 50 or, you know, why no cap at all?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, we don't have a lot of data right now. We do know that the amount of Alaska-grown products, this is fisheries may be a little bit different here, but as far as Alaska-grown agricultural products, there's a limited amount that's really being produced in quantity and in form that conforms with the needs of the potential buyers. Sometimes there's variation in the form of the product. Institution may require, I think we were using an example earlier of cut broccoli versus a head of broccoli, things like that. So there may be differences in form and how things are packaged and quantities available to meet an RFP. And so what the administration's looking for with this preference is, again, understanding the drive towards food security and independence, trying to really open doors for producers to expand their markets, and in this instance, to leverage the state's institutional buying power to do so. It's a step. I think that, you know, the division, the department is really aware that there's a lot more work that's going to need to go into expanding market access. But this is a step where we have a preference that's in statute that we can perhaps increase to take an immediate action, see some immediate gain, hopefully, while we're working on some of those longer term solutions.
May I follow up?
Okay, follow up, Representative Sadler.
Just briefly, I would have some concerns about essentially writing a blank check. I feel better with some parameters. The 7% is a current parameter. If I had information or evidence to say that was not effective, certainly if we guarantee prices up to infinity, we're likely to get more production and investment. And while I certainly support the goal of food security, you know, we must also protect the state exchequer.
Understood, sir.
Okay, let's try to push through the rest of the sectional then, Ms. Miller. Thank you.
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman. Section 16, at the end of the five-year period, removes that protection we just talked about of submitting those wholesale price lists for those municipal contracts. In Section 17, we're essentially going into different statute. This would be the procurement preference for the state agencies and school districts, and doing the exact same thing. In Section 18, at the end of 5 years, we revert to current statute. In Section 19, this again relates to the municipalities that receive state money. I'm sorry. Yeah, this one would be, I believe, related to fisheries products. And that one, again, we put the pilot in place for 5 years. And then in Section 20, we revert to current statute again. In Section 21, this is, again, a protection, same protection of requiring the wholesale price lists when responding to a state or school district solicitation for agricultural products. And in Section 22, that reverts to current statute that does not require the submission of the wholesale price list. And then in Section 23, we move out of the procurement world, and this goes back to the federal crop insurance contributions, and it prescribes the state's contribution towards crop insurance for each covered producer. Section 7, of course, establishes the new formula. Section 24 is where we require an annual report to the legislature that both the Department of Administration and Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development would put together. There's specific data in the bill that would be compiled and forwarded to the legislature annually during that five-year preference increase. Section 25 is essentially transitional language addressing how pending procurements would be addressed while you're transitioning to the new preference. In Section 26, we're allowing the Board of Agriculture and Conservation and DNR to implement regulations related to the bill. Section 7 sets an immediate effective date for Sections 1 related to the Board of Ag Quorum and Section 26 allowing regulations. Section 28 puts in the July 1, 2024 effective date for the five-year pilot procurement preference increase. Section 29 sets a July 1, 2025 effective date for the sections related to the state support for the federal crop insurance premiums. This will provide, you know, a year here if the bill is approved for the division and the Department of Law to work together on regulations for that program. And finally, on Section 30, there's a June 30th, 2029 effective date for those procurement sections to revert to current statute at the end of that five-year trial. That concludes the sectional.
Okay, thank you very much. One immediate question I have on the overall program is there a big problem with loan defaults, or do the farmers up here usually do a really good job of making their payments, and they have good record of paying these loans? And since it looks like we're going to expand the program, I guess I'd like to know how good How good is our credit?
Okay. For the record, Brian Scoresby, Director of the Division of Agriculture through DNR. Representative McKay, for your answer, we have in our portfolio 52 loans, as Deputy Director Goodrum said, and I think there is five that are in default right now. And we are working with all five of those on a regular basis to bring those loans current and paid off. And we're confident that that process will continue to work. Okay?
Okay.
I mean, with 52 loans, 5, 10% is in default. Okay? We have a pretty high, let me say, performance, in my opinion, of the kind of loans we do.
I would say, just based on observing farming in Alaska, I would say that's probably pretty good. It's a hard place to farm. Okay, we have Representative McCabe with a question.
Thanks. Not sure who, probably Mr. Goodrum. Early in your presentation, you mentioned that we were focused on grain, barley, and that sort of thing as sort of the initial part of our local meat, ranching cattle and that sort of thing. I'm interested to know what the DNR is doing and what we're doing to increase the number of USDA-approved meat processing plants, because I would hate to see us in the same issue as we were in with the milk, where we got all kinds of product and no way to get it to market, no way to sell it, no way to get it approved. So I know that this was maybe not last year, but 2 years ago, this was a major source of concern, because I think we were down to one place that could do it. And I'm wondering if we have done anything in that respect, because that's kind of the end of the supply chain, right? Or the end of this chain that you're talking about.
Yeah, through the chair, Brian Scoresby, Director of the Division of Ag. In the USDA slaughterhouses in the state, there's three of them, one in Delta Junction, one in North Pole, and one in Palmer. Okay, for a farmer, rancher growing livestock, he can sell live animals to anyone at whatever agreed price without a USDA inspection at slaughter. And there's some mobile slaughters that actually kill animals on site, deliver them to a processor, which are they're all over the place, and they can package it, process it, take it home. Okay, no law that says they can't, and it's perfectly legal by all standards. To get into the retail chain, it has to go through a USDA slaughter. And there are some protections for the rancher as well as the buyer when an animal gets slaughtered through a USDA-inspected facility. Okay, does that answer your question?
Follow up for McCabe. Yeah,
I think so. I just want to make sure that we don't kind of go through the same situation where we don't have, I know USDA meat, I think, do the prisons still need to use it? And I think the schools need to use USDA meat. And so there is a need in Alaska for USDA processors. And the state obviously doesn't want to get into picking and winners and losers, obviously, but we still have to make sure that we have the end game or the end processing for those products, if you will. So I know it was an issue a couple of years ago, and I just want to make sure. I think a couple of years ago we were down to one, right?
I think there was, through the chair, there was two at one time, but the problem with our slaughterhouses is lack of animals. Okay, it's not having overcapacity of animals versus slaughter capacity. It's a shortage of animals for slaughter capacity. Increased animals on the farm and being processed, killed and processed in the USDA facility would make all of them more successful, maybe to the point of profitable too.
Perfect. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have questions on a couple different sections. There's many sections. So my first question is going to be, Section 2 of the bill expands the functions for which ARLF can make loans to include shipping and refinancing.
And I think I looked at the fiscal note, it said the additional demand is unknown at this time. I guess I'm just going to ask the question on the record. This is inviting ARLF to make loans. Not quite sure what the total outstanding likelihood of the desire for refinancing. So is there any estimation of the amount of loans that are held by private, you know, borrowers that might be conceptually refinanced under this provision in Section 2?
Through the chair. Representative Sadler, we do not know who would come to us for a refinance request, but I'm confident that there is farm loans out there from other institutions that are at a higher interest rate than we are charging currently, and we would entertain some business from those. Refinance loan would still need to meet all ARLF criteria as current a new loan would.
Follow up, Representative Sadler.
The Commercial Fishing and Agriculture Bank makes similar kinds of loans. Do you have an idea what the CFAB loan portfolio might be that might be able to be refinanced at a lower interest rate through ARLF?
Through the chair, we would have to entertain those loans to see what they are. Okay. We do have in our portfolio some mariculture loans, mm-hmm. and we're really proud of those. You know, until we actually seen an application, we really would not know if it meets our criteria or not.
Another follow-up for me?
Representative Sadler.
Kind of the same line of questioning about shipping. This bill would propose to let ARLF finance shipping expenses with no cap other than that set by regulation. Is there any information as to how much what the demand might be for shipping loans to cover shipping?
For the record, this is Deputy Commissioner Goodrum. Through the chair, Representative Sadler. I don't know that we have that information yet, as this is a new concept that has been brought to us by some of the stakeholder groups that said forming some transportation co-ops would be very good for the industry. And so we still yet to see what that might be.
Okay. Representative Mears had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm a bit of a ringer on the topic, being on the Food Strategy Task Force, and have had the opportunity to work on some of these recommendations, and it's great to see this in front of us. And I do have follow-up conversations with the department coming, but I thought it would be good for the committee to know some of the things that I plan on talking about, and if there's any of them you'd like to comment about today. I've got three things on my list. One is that it's my understanding that manufacturers be included in the revolving loan fund. That was part of our discussions. But we're going to need to address another part of the statutes, which limits the power of the board for just farmers and homesteaders. So that's one of the topics. In Section 3, there's a change in loan repayment for the state of Alaska to be first priority. And then the final part we were getting into earlier as a committee, that we need to talk about having different guardrails on the procurement, that an unlimited dollar amount on those really constitutes an unfunded mandate to a lot of departments. And I'd like further discussion on that. Thank you.
I'm going to take those one at a time, gentlemen, or do you want to get back to us?
Through the chair, Deputy Commissioner Goodrum, I understood Representative Mears to be saying that these are topics that she's hoping to engage with us further on, as she's done a lot of work in the committee. And these are topics that, we want to learn more and have a good conversation with. So thank you, Chair.
Okay, so the Representative Mears, those are on the record, and you can refer to them, and then you'll address them at a future point.
Yes.
Okay. Representative Sadler had another question.
Yes, sir. Through the chair, Deputy Commissioner Goodrum, Section 1 would change the quorum for the BAC from 5 of 7 to 4 of 7. How often are properly noticed Board of Agriculture and Conservation meetings inhibited or canceled due to an absence of quorum? How bad is the problem this section seeks to address?
Through the chair, Brian Scoresby, Director of the Division of Ag. Representative Sadler, last Monday, a week ago, the board had scheduled a work session, and there was three members of the board came, and so they didn't have a quorum and couldn't conduct any work session at all. When a year ago, as an example, I was actually serving on the Board of Agriculture, And when the vacancy came up at the director's office, I applied. I was ultimately selected. But because of the quorum criteria of five, I had to sit in on the interviews when I was a board member but couldn't participate, and it created quite a conflict, being a board member without participation because I was one of the candidates for the position. And I'm confident that the board would really appreciate going to a quorum of four, which is kind of standard, a majority anyway. But anyway, that's I hope that answers your question.
And does it make brief
follow up, Representative Sadler?
To the chair, Mr. Scoresby. So generally, how difficult is it to find people who are willing to serve like yourself on the board?
Through the chair, we've been successful. One of the first tasks I did a year ago when I came on as director was to work to fill the vacancies that was on the board. And it is not easy. It's not paid. Nobody gets $50 or $25 to serve on the board. They get travel if we bring them in for a meeting. But it's purely a volunteer. We have Teams meetings for most of our meetings. And, you know, someone willing to serve, there's always somebody somewhere, but not everybody can. There is one restriction for the farming community, and that is you're not eligible to get an annual operating loan if you're serving on the board. And that can be a conflict, and it is a conflict in recruitment for board members.
Thank you.
Okay, any further questions on House Bill 296, the Crop Act?
Well, if I do it.
Is that a no or a yes, Representative Sadler?
I will take it, yes. to the chair, to whichever gentleman could better address it. In Section 2, my question number 2. So Sections 4 and 5, actually expand the numerological maximum loan amount from $250,000 to $500,000 or $200,000 to $500,000. But the other Section 3 just gets rid of that hard dollar, $1 million cap on loans and lets the BAC set those by regulation. Can you explain the thinking to me why some proposals in this bill would increase, just basically double the cap, but the $1 million cap would be discarded entirely?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, Deputy Commissioner Goodrum, not doing away with just the $1 million cap, it would later be set in regulation by the board. And so in some cases, it was just thought that these numbers made sense while allowing flexibility for the board to consider other caps that are better done in regulations. And so I realize it's a little bit of a mix on, you know, what's going to go into the regulatory process, but that was what was decided when the bill was being drafted.
Thank you, sure.
Okay. Okay. Seeing no other questions on House Bill 296, we'll set the bill aside, and we plan to do public testimony on Wednesday, our next meeting. So with that, I would like to thank Ms. Miller, Mr. Goodrum, and Mr. Scoresby for their presentations today and for answering our questions. So with that, let's take just a brief at ease while they can clear out. Okay, we're back on the record at House Resources, and now we will take up House Bill 257, which relates to seismic data in Cook Inlet and I believe Middle Earth. So I bring House Bill 257 back before the committee. We have received no amendments. We do have an updated fiscal note from the department that we will attach to the committee report. And with that, I would entertain a motion to move the bill.
Mr. Chairman, I
move. Representative Rauscher.
No worries. I move to report HB 257, Work Order 33-LS1011/B from the committee with individual recommendations and one attached to fiscal note.
Objection. Okay, thank you, Representative Rauscher. We have an objection. So, Justin, can you call the roll?
Can you take a brief at ease first?
Brief at ease. Here, back on the record. And Justin, can you please call the roll?
Representative Rauscher.
Did you vote?
I'm sorry.
Yes.
Representative Sadler?
Yes. Yes.
Representative Armstrong?
Yes.
Representative Mears?
No.
Representative Diver?
Yes.
Representative McCabe?
Yes.
Representative Baker?
Yes.
And Chair McCabe?
Yes.
Seven yeas, one nay.
What was that count again?
I'm sorry, 7 yeas, 1 nay.
7-1. Okay. So on a vote of 7 yeas and 1 nay, House Bill 257 has been passed out of Resources Committee. Thank you very much, everyone. And we will now sign the record. Brief at ease. Okay, we're back on the record of House Resources, and that concludes our work on House Bill 257. Thank you, everyone. And we're going to hold over House Bill 281, recreational cabins. The department is still doing some work on some of the questions that we've had on that bill. So that concludes our business for today. We will meet again on Wednesday at 1 o'clock, and we will adjourn today at 2:19 p.m. Thank you.